You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Good afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us. My name is Vago Maradian. I'm the editor of Defense News and the host of This Week in Defense News. And our guest today needs no introduction, Dr. Harold Brown. And I want to thank Dr. Brown, his co-author, Joyce Winslow, and the Brookings Institution for facilitating today's discussion. I'm honored for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first is I've long admired Dr. Brown for his record of achievement. I mean, I think it's few would argue that few people were better equipped to be Secretary of Defense at the time that they took over the job, nor, frankly, more effectively and more actively shaped the military that we have today in terms of all the technological revolutions from the advent of the thermonuclear weapons all the way to GPS, to precision strike, to stealth, and so many other capabilities developed under his watch, whether he was at Livermore Lab, whether he was DDR&E, whether he was Air Force Secretary, or whether he was Secretary of Defense. I'm also honored because he was Secretary. His secretaryship coincided with me as a fellow Upper West Sider, although I have to say as an 11-year-old Upper West Sider at the time, who came to full consciousness of the defense and foreign policy world. So I will not draw on any of my lessons from that tenure, sir, and merely start. We're going to start with me asking some questions and then opening it up to the floor, and then give all of you an opportunity to go to the back and buy a copy of a very good book that I certainly enjoyed. And maybe even get it signed free of charge, actually. So it's a deal really at twice the price. And I get no cut of it, frankly, as an agent. So, we'll just move right into the questioning. Sir, I'd like to start with the budget. I mean, in your book, you make clear that, DOD has already cut $500 billion from defense spending under the Budget Control Act. Over 10 years. And that another cut of equal magnitude through sequestration, you argued at the time before sequestration became a reality, would be a very bad thing. And yet, despite the military leadership saying it was a bad thing, it's happened nonetheless. Why shouldn't defense spending be cut by another $500 billion? And if it does have to be cut, what's the best way to cut it?
Clearly, we're on the road to cutting another $500 billion over 10 years, although only the first year is really set in stone. And my book failed to prevent that from happening.
Maybe it's because you were too thoughtful and measured in the way you made your case.
No, no. I think that I still believe that this next $500 billion, $50 billion a year over 10 years, is going to be damaging. It could be less damaging if steps are taken to mitigate the damage. But we will have less military capability at a time when the threats remain real. They're not existential in the way that the competition with the Soviet Union was or could have been. But they could be very damaging to U.S. security and to the well-being of individual citizens. How should we deal with it? Well, the first $50 billion, on top of the previous $500 billion,
right,
is going to go into effect. And it will be met, I think, largely by personnel cuts and by postponing equipment modernization. Part of the problem is that canceling programs, even programs that ought to be canceled, doesn't produce an immediate savings because procurement spreads out its expenditure over a long period and you don't get the full benefit in the first year. So I think what will happen is that there will be personnel cuts. I think land forces in particular will be cut, and I think that some programs will be postponed. That's not the best way to go at it, There are ways to deal with this that I think would be considerably less damaging.
For example?
I give some examples in the book. There are clearly too many levels of management in the Defense Department. I propose, for example, eliminating the secretaries of the military departments. Now, that's not a large number of people. That's not where the money would get saved. The money would get saved by reducing the delays and the complications of having additional levels of management, which in each service duplicates a civilian layer, the secretariat, over the senior military layer, that of the chief of staff. There's an example. Another example is something that is a good change, but has perhaps blossomed into some waste. And that is the emphasis on the unified and specified commands, which really do the fighting and do the operations, unlike the services, which essentially are the support functions. These are the Pacific Command, for example, the Southern Command, geographical commands and functional commands. What's happened is that they have taken on a big job, and what they've done is they've, in many cases, established Washington staffs essentially to be their lobbies. And that's duplicative. Those can be cut. I think some programs can be canceled or at least reduced. I would reduce the F-35 program, for example, substantially. I think, well, those are just some examples. How much are we, can we save by doing that? I think we probably can save most of that $50 billion the first year. Whether we can actually manage the rest of the $500 billion over 10 years by doing these things, I'm not sure. And in fact, I doubt it. In that case, we will probably have to cut some activities. I think our forces in Europe can probably be reduced further, and I think that will certainly have to be done if there is really to be a pivot to Asia, for example.
Let me take you to the reform question first, though, because one of the things you did in becoming Secretary of Defense was try to reduce staff functions, to shorten lines of control, to be able to operate the place more effectively, and that kind of thing always raises a hue and cry. What are some of the incentives, and politically, how would you engineer it in order to be able to get that reduction in overhead that everybody said is squandering resources?
Well, that's indeed the $500 billion question, because the very same members of Congress who were willing to see the $500 billion cut are going to complain and, in fact, prevent some of the things that are necessary to meet that cut. For example, over 10 years, we can probably save quite a lot of money by closing some bases. Unfortunately, you don't save it in the first year. It actually costs you more. But over 10 years, you do save by closing bases. But every congressman who said, cut defense, means cut defense outside of my district.
Right.
Now, what's the solution? I'm not sure there is one, but I think that the president, I think, should make a stronger case in whenever something like that happens, and I'm not sure that that will take place. We'll see.
Secretary Hagel launched a strategic choices and management review that's due at the end of this month that's going to be shaping the quadrennial defense review that's mm-hmm. to come. And there are some folks who are looking at this as justification in order to cut another $52 billion next year. There are other people who are saying that, no, this is going to be a genuine attempt to try to find where to make some of these strategic choices at the end of the day. There are those who say that if we do this right, And if you even suggested it, if we get rid of the bloat, then we would be able to perhaps do as much on less money. Can we spend less money, or does spending less money mean ultimately, given the politics of this, that we're just going to get less? And what are some of the big thinking things we may have to do?
It's not
obligation and commitment wise around the world.
It's not inevitable that the cut will result in less capability, but it's very likely for the reasons that I've said. And I think we have to look at two different pieces of this. One is the strategic piece. For example, having less of a footprint in Europe, for example. And perhaps even encouraging some of our allies to be more efficient. I mean, bad as we are at waste and mistakes, most of them are worse.
And just multiplied over 28 different countries.
Yes. So a difference in strategy, a difference in allocation of forces. I mean, for example, not only pulling back, not only reducing U.S. bases, but reducing permanent bases overseas and replacing that activity with occasional deployments into host country bases, essentially. And that's going to be, I think, especially important in the Pacific. So that's one level. I don't think that we can reduce our commitments to allies in the Pacific, but I do think that we can probably reduce some of our commitments or some of our deployments, certainly avoiding future wars in the Middle East, Persian Gulf area, for example. So that's the strategic level. But then separately, there is the matter of how efficiently we run our own military. And that's what I've been talking about just a while ago. And I go into considerable detail in the book.
Do we need, and we didn't talk about this earlier, but you're a believer in the strategic triad. And there are some folks who say that we should go to a dyad of maintain the submarine-launched missiles that are more survivable, some would argue, than land-based systems, and go with a bomber force, a nuclear-capable bomber force, and get rid of the land-based ICBMs. Is that a good idea or not?
Well, the land-based ICBMs perhaps are the most excess in terms of providing additional capability, but they're also the cheapest, so that you probably can get by at a lower overall cost with a triad than with a dyad. Because the one that you'd eliminate is the one that costs the least amount of money. And in general, what you find when you analyze these systems is that the minimum overall cost is a mix of the three. We are due to have a new generation of ballistic missile submarines. Those are going to be enormously expensive, and they're being pushed perhaps a year ahead of the time that they really need to be. The current generation really needs to be replaced. Apparently, 30 years is as long as a submarine is considered viable. Although, interestingly enough, we have bomber aircraft that are now 50-odd years old and are still flying. It must be the salt that does it. So if you think about it, just delaying the submarine replacements by a year or two probably would save more money than phasing out the land-based ballistic missiles.
So far, there's been a remarkable amount of comedy among the service chiefs that folks expect will not last particularly deeper cuts. If you were going to prioritize, say, the submarine, the JSF, the long-range bomber, which one of the programs or the refueling aircraft or what have you, which are the ones that would be priority ones that you would protect, and what are the ones you would be willing to take more risk on?
Well, I would protect the long-range bomber simply because overseas bases are going to become more and more vulnerable, and that means that the tactical aircraft are going to be less universally usable. They'll still be very important, but there are going to be more and more circumstances under which we're going to want to operate from domestic bases when it comes to aircraft strike aircraft.
So you would have that be a big aircraft with transcontinental range and large payload?
Yes. And I think it can be manned. It can be a manned aircraft at rather minor incremental cost. So I would push that one. I would ease off somewhat on the tactical aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Among the threats that folks are looking at and saying, for example, the bomber is so important, the issue comes to China. And you have a long history with China. The nation is an absolutely critical trading partner for the United States. But that doesn't mean that conflict hasn't erupted between rising powers, even when they're good and close trading partners, as you note. You give a lot of historic examples in the book. It also goes back to the book. I'm going to try to mention the book as many times as I can while I'm up here. Beijing is using this wealth and developing a military capability that it's increasingly using to try to bully its neighbors. Even when General Dempsey was in Beijing, there was the issue over the Senkakus, the latest American official to sort of be upstaged by his hosts. For good measure, the Chinese sent a unit into India, into disputed territory there. They've managed to irritate both Indonesia and Malaysia that have been generally warmer toward Beijing than not. Continue to bully the Philippines, for example. And so a large part of the pivot is obviously reassuring folks, but at the same time, both Dempsey and Hagel have told Beijing, look, if there's shooting starts between you and Japan, we've got to back Japan. And then the Japanese have come out of their shell and basically said, you know, we were willing to fight over the Senkakus, which is a pretty dramatic thing for Japanese guys to say. What's the outlook here? And what's the right way to be balancing China's ambitions and its interests with our interests and our obligations so that we mutually manage to avoid a conflict?
China is a rising power, and rising powers push their neighbors around. The U.S. did it when it was a rising power, and we can expect China to do the same thing. The neighbors then turn to someone else for help, and we're the someone they've turned to. And I think it is important for us to support them, but at the same time, keep them from provoking China. And there's been some of that, actually, as well. I think that the U.S.-China relationship is going to define the next 50 years. And I think that rising powers have in the past come into conflict with the status quo power, which is what the U.S. is, the existing dominant world power. The existence of nuclear weapons on both sides has the effect both of causing them to think carefully about getting into military conflict and making military conflict less likely, but catastrophic if it happens. And that's the trade that we're essentially stuck with. And so long as we and the Chinese both realize it, I think we may be able to come through this all right without a massive conflict. How do we deal with it in the meantime? I think we have to be very careful, but at the same time, we have to make it clear to the Chinese that we have interests that we're going to defend in the Western Pacific, and that we will stand by our allies at the same time that we tell our allies that the Chinese are going to become more and more important in the region. The situation is complicated by the fact that the Chinese depend on us for markets, and we depend on the Chinese for financing. As I say in the book, the parallel situation, not identical, was that before World War I, France and Germany were their biggest trading partners. That didn't prevent a war.
Right.
I think it will not prevent, in this case, between the U.S. and China, lots of conflict. But I think that doesn't necessarily need to lead to war. Part of our problem, I think, at the moment is that the Chinese are not only pushing their neighbors around, they're feeling their oats, and they see the United States as a declining power. I think they're mistaken in that. At least, I hope they're mistaken, and I think there's no need for them to be right. That depends on us.
Right.
I think that they may be surprised as the U.S. recovers, which it will do. they have their own problems, and I think we sometimes underestimate those problems.
From your standpoint, what are they? I mean, for example, almost everything is about making sure that growth continues and they maintain control, which is... it's a fear of dropping the marbles, I guess, and losing them all.
Look, there are 1.2 billion people. That makes it awfully hard to exercise central control. And yet, they're an authoritarian state run by the party, except that they're not able to run everything. And I'm sure that the Chinese leadership is equally directed at continuing growth and preventing unrest. That's not an easy thing for them to do. I think mostly the leadership is concentrating on internal matters. But as part of that, they depend upon the military and the paramilitary, the People's Armed Police, for control. And correspondingly, they give them a fair amount of latitude. And the military is even more rambunctious than the political leadership, mm-hmm. and could get them in bad trouble. I mean, there have been several situations in which they appear to have acted independently without checking with the political leadership.
Right.
That's pretty dangerous. One reason to try to get military to military and politico-military to politico-military dialogue going is to expose the Chinese political leadership to the way we have managed in our country to have the political leadership control the military. They're so far reluctant to do that.
We answer the phone, though, and they have a tendency of not answering the phone when stuff goes on.
What's happened is their military has precipitated a number of incidents of which the political leadership was not aware before or at the time that could have been very dangerous. They need a structure to manage that. That doesn't have to be identical to our structure with the National Security Council and so forth, but they need one, and a dialogue between the two sides could help produce that.
Right.
I hope that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, when he was talking to his Chinese counterpart, managed to get that across.
What is the 3 a.m. phone call from the Pacific that could trigger U.S. military action in the region? And what are the scenarios that keep you awake or wake you from a sound sleep? You know, Bob Work, the Deputy Navy Secretary, used to love saying that he sleeps like a baby. He wakes up every 2 hours screaming. So, what?
Well, I don't expect a phone call anymore, so that it's easy for me to sleep. One possibility, of course, is a North Korean action. They seem to have finished their temper tantrum for the moment, but you never know. They could do something more extreme than they've done in the past, and that could precipitate a...
And they've done some very extreme things in the past.
Indeed they have. I don't... If, for example, they were suddenly to launch a few artillery strikes at Seoul to show that they mean business, that would get our attention pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. That's one possibility. Another, of course, is something happening in Pakistan with the Pakistani nuclear capabilities going astray. That would be pretty tough to handle.
Or Japanese shooting a Chinese over the Senkakus.
Yes, that also. I mean, the Japanese are showing that their concerns about China's military rise and Chinese military or paric or quasi-military behavior makes things more dicey there. We've said to the Chinese that we support the Japanese authority in the Senkakus. But at the same time, I think we've tried to cool off the Japanese, mm-hmm. who, under new Prime Minister Abe, are certainly showing more willingness to improve their military capability and to say that they're prepared to use it.
We just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. And there are folks who make, at least suggest, connections in the way the administration perhaps thinks about Syria in an Iraq light, that war was about WMDs, and so let's not get involved in another Middle East war that may or may not involve WMDs and how they may be used. And obviously there's the red line used by the president that has some people saying, look, at this point we have to act. You spend a lot of time in the book, and I commend you for this, about saying, like, how to use force, what are the challenges, what are the issues, why would you use force, why would you not use force, with particularly good lines from guys like John Quincy Adams and Lord Palmerston thrown in there for good measure. But should America get involved in Syria, and if not, why not, and what's kind of a broader way of thinking about the deployment of American force in this era of fiscal austerity but great strategic challenge?
We need to be pretty sure that we understand the situation before we get into it. I think Iraq is an example, and then Vietnam is an example, of U.S. involvement on the ground in situations where the past was not fully understood by the people who made the decisions, and the forces involved were not properly assessed by our decision makers. Syria is another such case. Does that mean that we should never get involved? No, it doesn't mean that, but it means that we need to be very, very careful. The use of chemical warfare is reprehensible. But although we categorize it as a weapon of mass destruction, it's not the same as nuclear weapons. It's not the same as biological weapons. We should not commit to doing something without knowing just how we're going to do it when we do it.
even if we've called it a red line.
I think, look, there's a problem. Once you say there's a red line, if you don't act after that red line is crossed, then you've hurt your credibility. On the other hand,